You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson.
Over winter break, I saw the revival of the musical Sunset Boulevard on Broadway. The movie turned musical, and subsequent revivals have a long history, both in their presentations and in the stars that took on the role of Norma Desmond. In case you aren't familiar, the 1950 film Sunset Boulevard centers around a down-and-out writer who stumbles upon the mansion of former silent film star Nora Desmond, who is plotting her revival on screen. She employs the writer to edit a screenplay she hopes will facilitate her big comeback, a depiction of the story of Salome, in which she will play the 16-year-old character. Desmond, a film star of the silent film era, couldn't break into the new medium at the advent of talking pictures. Jaded and haunted by her lost fame, the reality of her situation becomes too real as her obsession over the writer she employs turns deadly after her confession of love for him. Ending with one of the most iconic lines in film history, where Desmond slowly descends the stairs of her mansion and utters the line, "Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up." My interest in Sunset Boulevard emerged after an encounter in the archives at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. The Ransom Center holds the archival collection of Gloria Swanson, the actress who originated the role of Desmond in the original Billy Wilder film from 1950. The collection includes 620 boxes of archival materials, almost 292 linear feet of material, which include personal photographs, fan mail, scripts, and related materials from her health foods activism, among a litany of other items. The collection is whispered about by archivists and interns at the Ransom Center because of a notorious object included in the archive, a small, handmade coffin painted green that arrived at the archive filled with sugar. The coffin has the pan-painted text, "Hic jacet Gloria Swanson," or when translated, "Here lies Gloria Swanson," painted on its top. The coffin is rough, obviously quickly made, but is undeniably the thing it aims to represent. The coffin is part of a series of anonymous hate mail sent from the filmmaker Kenneth Anger to Swanson in the late 1970s. Alongside the coffin, other items include a series of annotated postcards which depict cartoon cats engaging in surreal scenarios. These scenes include a wedding, a family photograph, a hair salon, and a moving scene, among a few others. Anger has sequenced them and typed references to moments in Swanson's life directly on the illustrations and added the statement, "This is your life," to the back of each. Then there is also the photograph of her and the actor Rudolph Valentino, stabbed through with pushpins, a glass thermometer, and other sharp objects, operating almost as if it is a voodoo doll. Occasionally, Anger also sent her a series of sugar packets, meant to poke fun at Swanson's health food advocacy and anti-sugar campaigning. Swanson married author William Dufty, who years prior had confronted him about his sugar intake at a cafe when he popped a sugar cube into his coffee. The interaction inspired Dufty to write a book entitled Sugar Blues, dedicated to Swanson, which aimed to reveal the evils of sugar and expose the way sugar is totally immersed in the things we eat. For his final act, after the months-long campaign, Anger revealed himself through a signed headshot, hand-painted with the caption, "For faded glory, season's curses, Anger." On the white border of this photograph, Anger pinned in a curse, which when Googled is revealed to be an occult spell meant to protect against vicious creatures. I'm not sure if Anger is providing a shield against himself to Swanson or the opposite. The headshot accompanied a letter which read, "Vainglorious lady, odd how in the years since Sunset Boulevard, you have ceased to be Swanson and have become Desmond. Reflections, Kenneth Anger." In this, Anger directly accuses Swanson of becoming her character from Sunset Boulevard. These letters, along with some of the other materials he mailed, were sent with a stamp commemorating the 50th anniversary of Talking Pictures, a direct jab at Swanson's own difficulty making the transition to talking films. An incredibly small detail that Swanson herself may not have even noticed when looking through the mail she received. These are just some of the highlights of items that Anger sent to Swanson. The materials are dramatic, harsh, and mean, of course, but are obviously generated by someone with a deep understanding of this star's personal and professional life. Anger began his hate mail campaign after being sued by Swanson for libel, as she took issue with the characterization Anger attributed to her in his book, Hollywood Babylon. The book and its subsequent sequel present a history of Hollywood's gossip, as Anger alleges to have heard it and experienced it growing up in the early days of Hollywood's golden age. I interpret Anger's anger at Swanson as partially related to his inability to be a film star in his own right. Anger, as a child, starred in the 1935 version of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and acted in his own films early in his career, but eventually took the helm of directing behind the camera. Swanson was a well-known actress who would have been idolized by Anger, but her litigious rebuttal against him would have corrupted his image of her in his mind. Anger projects his own inability to be a star when tearing down Swanson. My interactions with this archival material resulted in an exhibition and body of work which played with a number of the materials sent by Anger, using facsimiles of some of the archival materials, sugar, and press photographs found on eBay. I also generated a short film, which the exhibition revolved around, entitled The Sugar Coffin. In my ongoing research for these projects, the Broadway musical version of Sunset Boulevard kept popping up in YouTube searches and on Google. Written by Andrew Lloyd Webber, the musical premiered in 1993 on London's West End, and closely follows the contours of the original movie, but now set to song. The production has played host to many divas over the years, including Patti LuPone, who originated the role on the West End, Glenn Close, who famously replaced LuPone when the musical moved to Broadway, and who played the role twice, 25 years apart, and now Nicole Scherzinger of Pussycat Dolls fame in the current revival. This revival is stripped down, removing much of the embellishment and ornamentation of the original film and prior musical, leaving an empty stage populated only by its cast and a set of roving handheld cameras. The revival complicates and plays with the presence of the camera, capturing video that creates an instant feedback loop when projected on a screen at the back of the stage. There is both the acting for the audience present in the room, as well as the attention paid to the camera. I wanted to see this production because of the freedom associated with the revival. The production isn't bogged down in preserving the canon of the reference material. It allows for a new take, free from the weight of its subject matter. It doesn't need the ostentatious house or fake dead monkey to create the sense of place on stage. Scherzinger's version of Norma Desmond was clear and incredible, and she embodied the diva status needed for the role. I was excited to be in a theater with nearly 1,000 people, anxious to witness the hot new thing on stage. On the night I watched the musical in late December 2024, the audience acted as a collective body, and there was a general excitement and seeming anxiety tied to the hope that the performance would live up to the hype. As someone who has listened to the revival soundtrack over and over, it was exciting to hear and see the nuances of a live version of what had been produced to the nth degree on the album. There was a humanity to the performance, and it was incredibly important that everything was done by a group of humans in front of us. One moment that stuck with me is a near catastrophe that is inherent in live performance. During Scherzinger's rendition of With One Look, one of two main songs where Scherzinger is supposed to embody an otherworldly force and must hold a high note for nearly 10 seconds, Scherzinger flubbed the note. On this night, in the middle of the song, when she sings the word home for 10 seconds, the note went sour, turning mid-word into an off-kilter scream rather than the beautifully rendered version captured on the soundtrack. In the room, the nearly 1,000-person audience tensed up, and one could feel the room hold its breath as we waited to see if Scherzinger could bring the note back into control. The woman next to me even covered her ears as the scream amplified around the room. Scherzinger finished the note and aimed to redeem herself by following up on it with even more force in the following words, reclaiming the stage and the song, leading to thunderous applause at the end of the song. We had witnessed a star fall back to earth and redeem herself, quickly rebuilding the armor she had inadvertently lost for a few seconds. It was all I could hope for in a live performance, and I'm happy I experienced the collective thrill of witnessing a star's rise, partial fall, and an eventual redemption on stage. I think it truly lived up to the ideals of Sunset Boulevard.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Hello, this is who is a biomedical engineer and an aspiring bio artist. So Joseph, can we talk about how we were just talking earlier about you thinking of yourself as a mutant when you were a child, and that you always knew that you were going to be a scientist? In a similar way that I can relate to that is that I always knew that I would be an artist. So do you want to speak a little more about your early fascination with science?
So when I was a kid, first grade, I was crying, and I don't quite remember why. I think it was because I didn't have any friends. And I remember this kid came up to me, who would soon be like my best friend, and We're still friends today on Facebook. I haven't seen him in a few years, but he asked me why I was crying, and I said, oh, it's because I'm a mutant. And he said, well, I'm also a mutant. And there was a school-long friendship formed from that. And when I was that age, I don't know where I got the concept of what a mutant was, or even like what the bio, like the scientific concept of what a mutant was. And so when people ask me how I knew that I was a scientist, I don't really have a answer. There wasn't like a grand inciting incident about like, oh, I knew that I wanted to pursue therapeutics to cure cancer, or I knew that I wanted to treat neurodegenerative disorders or things like that. I just felt that I was different in some way, and that's why I always felt like I was a scientist.
Okay, I think I can also speak to that in a way that, like, the reason that I always knew that I was an artist is because I would always, like, do the simple thing in the most weirdest way possible. And that is something that I've continued to do till this day. Like the way that I understand making today is that it's just, like, the world is just your playground, and you just, you know, give yourself the margin to play around with fields without having any one tag to yourself. That is a very interesting position to be in, and that is what, yeah, that is what being an artist for me is, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so earlier we were also talking about how you think that art and science are the same thing. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, so when I came to Pentagon, I came under the impression that art and science were inherently the same thing. And I came here believing that because with art, you are making something that hasn't existed before. And with science, you are studying the theory behind something that hasn't existed before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of working to an end to make something that hasn't existed before. But during my time here, I realized that there's a pretty hard segregation between the two things for some reason. Now I have more of a science background, and so I remember I talking to various PIs about it, and they didn't consider that art could be science. And I found that, like, really troubling.
Uh-huh.
Because it doesn't really go the other way. I don't think there's people that think science can't be art, but a lot of scientists think art can't be science. And I think that's very problematic in so many ways. I think that limits accessibility, that limits creativity, and that is ultimately bad for the advancement of human innovation and technology.
I agree.
Yeah.
But do you think that academia has a lot of part to play in that? Because also, like, Carnegie Mellon is a university famously known for computer science, which has a art school in the middle of it. So that kind of fosters a certain culture. Like, even as an artist, like, I feel like the corporate vibe of this space just does not let you do much. Like, I come from a very traditional art school, and the way that the spaces are built, they are built for interaction, where you will find artists, like, you know, in every other hallway, or, like, you know, there's, like, certain places that foster a culture of collaboration and interaction, which a space like Carnegie Mellon is, because it's, like, yeah, I mean, I think that this space, just because of the way that it's built, fosters a culture that it is harder to collaborate.
Absolutely. And I think you and me both entered Carnegie Mellon at this kind of, like, adolescent period. Because, like you were saying, Carnegie Mellon is, I believe it's still the number one computer science school in America, and I believe that makes it in the world. And so there's a huge influx of people that are coming to Carnegie Mellon just for the computer science aspects.
Yeah.
Whereas Carnegie Mellon, to me, like, when I was, like, a teen, was, like, a super big art school, and it was also like a big robotics school.
Oh.
And I think right now we're at the kind of precipice where Carnegie Mellon might become more interdisciplinary, might involve more science and art collaborations in the future. But I think right now there isn't a lot of collaboration, and I think that is wider academic problem. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily in like the bigger, more funded schools, like say Harvard.
Uh-huh.
And MIT, in fact, actually has a lot of like the MIT Multimedia Lab, in fact, has a lot of like technological and artistic crossovers. But I think in the whole of academia, there's a pretty big distinction between science and art. And if one wants to see those collaborations in action, they're going to have to look more to like the private sector and like individual artists outside of academia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to segue here a little bit and talk about what you said earlier about how when I said that I, as an artist, feel like I'm obsessed with materiality, and you responded by saying that you feel an aversion to material, which is an interesting point, because like many of the things that we have been talking about in our interactions are very similar, but then when it comes to dealing with material, we have very different approaches. So what is your relationship to materiality?
Well, so when you ask me if I have any materials that I'm obsessed with, my mind immediately snapped to my time as like a material scientist, which was kind of a fucking nightmare. Should I swear?
No, okay. But it's okay. We'll cut that out.
Okay. Which was kind of a nightmare, because it was a corporate hellscape, and it was a lot of heavy chemistry, and while it was a stable job and paid the bills, I really despised it because it was a lot of, not even hard science, it was a lot of ratio mixing and then troubleshooting and then processing for scale up. And so when I think of materials from a scientific perspective, I think of that job. And so I never ever want to go back to that mindset I had when thinking about materials. Now, as an artist, I don't have a particular material that I'm obsessed with, at least not yet. I'm sure there might be phases in my life where I swap to something or form an interest in something. But I don't believe that I'll ever have like a lifelong interest in a certain material, and I kind of hope that I don't.
The reason that I'm very interested in this question of materiality is because, like, I feel like, you know, we have spoken about this, about the fact that art and science at the heart of it can be thought of as one thing. And I do think that materiality becomes that very thing that leads these things, like, that joins art and science being one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But just the approaches towards that then become point of difference.
Yes.
Because we deal with the ideas of and questions of representation, whereas you deal with the functionality of it more than, you know, any ethical, moral, or, you know, political questions around what that thing is.
Precisely.
You have a more function, like your relationship towards it is more practical, and it also, and that's, I think, the point where you are very critical of science is because, you know, it always is serving into a corporate framework.
Yes.
Where it has to be profitable. Yeah.
Precisely. And that's why I don't think I liked my time as a material scientist, is because it was all very profit driven. It was all very pragmatic, and it all served a means to an end, however granular it might have been. And it had to be particularly granular because it had to be safe so that it couldn't be wildly experimental, because it couldn't shake up the industry too much.
Yeah.
And it had to be profitable. And so it had to be small, incremental baby steps forward for the sake of profitability. And while I think there should be a kind of temperance of the advancement of science, particularly in biosciences, I think the temperance of the advancement of science for profitability, for marketability, is stifling, absolutely stifling.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it, I think both artists and scientists believe that the world could be a better place.
100%.
Yes. And that's an interesting thought. Maybe there's a scientist and an artist who think the world could be a worse place and they work towards it. But artists and scientists believe the world could be a better place.
Yeah.
And I think when you see that the world's areas where the world could be a better place, and you see that it's just not happening, it can be very frustrating. It mm-hmm. can be very consuming to your soul.
100%. I think that's a good point to end. We're almost at 12 minutes. Thank you so much, Joseph.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude. We'll be right back.
don't love me like I love him, the way that he should. I got it bad, and that ain't good. My poor heart is sentimental, not made of wood. I got it bad, and that ain't good. And where I started out, just crying my heart out. Lord above me, please make him love me that he should. I got it back. I'm right back where I started out, just crying my heart out. Lord above me, please make him love me the way that he should. I got it bad, and that ain't good.
Think about your mother, your sister, your girlfriend. One in six women is a victim of sexual assault. Now think about your father, your brother, your best friend. Men are victims too. Rape can happen to anyone. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, encouraging you to call the National Sexual Assault Hotline to learn how to support someone you love. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAIN.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
one piece of wisdom that sticks in my head. I heard it someplace, or it's something I read about someone or other whose grandmother said that life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to play solitaire. Get off your duff, it's time to begin. There's good deeds to do, and there's sins to be sinned, and there's not enough time to fit it all in. Life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to eat processed cheese or mealy tomatoes or third-rate Chinese or to live someplace dismal without any trees. And life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to play solitaire. Get off your duff, it's time to begin. There's good deeds to do, and there's sins to be sinned, and there's not enough time to fit it all in. Life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to spend it alone, or with folks that are mean, or a long way from home, or to serve an obsession that isn't your own. And life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to fold underwear. Life is too short to play solitaire. Get off your duff, it's time to begin. There's good deeds to do, and there's sins to be sinned, and there's not enough time to fit it all in. Life is too short to fold underwear. Yes, life is too short to fold underwear.
Company that is, hello, this is Larry Berger along with Ricky Berger, and this is the show that gets your weekend off to a good start. The Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings at WRCT Pittsburgh, WIUP FM Indiana, WMCO New Concord, WSHA FM Grove City, WCUC FM Clarion, WNJR, Washington, WKYW, LP, Kaiser, West Virginia, Mountain Streams Radio, .org, Tube City Online at WMCK.FM, McKeesport, by ordinary telephone at 631-359-8728, and internet radio stations and streaming services. Like TuneIn, Streama, Simple Radio, and others, all listed at slbradio.org/radio. Today at 8:20, a movie you might really love that's about to be presented as a play, 12 Angry Men. We'll talk about with Wayne Brenda about that play, which opens May 2nd at the new Hazlett Theater. Wayne is with Prime Stage. We also have an Herbs in Action feature from our podcast series. We'll talk about Resurrection Fern. Between 10 and 11 o'clock, we have Keystone Oaks School District students who are heading to the Nationals in the Odyssey of the Mind World Finals in Lansing, Michigan. We also have writers from the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards Program. And at 11 o'clock, a folk trio known as Acacia Wood. That plus puzzles and games and lots of fun and good cheer. Thanks for joining us here for the show that gets your weekend off to a good start. Ours too, the Saturday Light Brigade. Saturday mornings here at the Saturday Light Brigade.